Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to the next of the Little Atoms Road Trip podcasts. I'm in Pasadena in California, where I've spent most of the day at the California Institute of Technology. And I spent the morning having a great chat with Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech. His papers on dark matter and dark energy, the physics of extra dimensions, and alternative theories of gravity have been widely praised. He is also one of the founders of the group blog CosmicVariance.com, named one of the top five science blogs by Nature. And in this interview, we talk about dark matter and dark energy, and also Sean's recent foray into popular science writing, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. So I'm talking to Sean Carroll. Sean, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
My pleasure.
You have a number of areas of expertise, and I'd like to look at a couple of those before we look at the book. We're going to spend most of the time looking at your recent book, From Eternity to Here, but we'll look at a couple of other things first. And the first thing I'd like to dive straight into is dark matter. Mm-hmm. So let's first of all talk about where the idea that there might be something called dark matter came from.
Well, it's not so mysterious when you think about it. Dark matter is just matter that is out there, and we can tell that it exists because it exerts a gravitational field. We can sort of feel its influence, but you can't see it, and that's not at all mysterious. You can't see the air, after all, but you can feel that it's there by waving your hands around. So it was actually way back in the 1930s that a Caltech astronomer named Fritz Zwicky measured the weight of a cluster of galaxies, the Coma Cluster, by looking at how fast the galaxies were moving, basically. The more matter there is, the faster the galaxies will move. So he weighed it, then he compared that to how much matter you see by counting up the stars, and he realized there was a lot more matter there than you could see. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, in the 1930s, it was certainly plausible that there was just matter you couldn't see, I mean, just like we can't see the air. It wasn't until the 70s that Vera Rubin and other astronomers looked at individual galaxies, and they realized that even though the amount of visible matter got less and less as you got further and further away from the center of the galaxy, the gravitational pull didn't go down like that. There was clearly more matter at the external regions of galaxies than in the internal regions. Eventually, we realized that there's no way this could be hidden ordinary matter. It's something brand new, and we called it dark matter.
Well, you mentioned there about there being more matter at certain regions of a galaxy, and you know, we talk about the discovery of dark matter as being when people were studying the mass of galaxies, and so it's always easy to imagine it as being like large clumps of dark matter out in various places in space. But is that true? Is it more widely distributed? So is there dark matter everywhere, like in here in this room, for instance?
We believe there's dark matter everywhere, even in this room. The fact that it's dark means that it doesn't interact very strongly with ordinary matter. Mm-hmm. So the dark matter particles can just be passing right through your body right now, and you would never know. Otherwise, we'd have detected it a long time ago. At least that's the most plausible model for dark matter to be. So then you ask the question, well, how is it distributed in the universe? And because it doesn't interact with ordinary matter very noticeably, we also think it probably doesn't interact with itself very noticeably. And that's an idea that seems to fit the data about where the dark matter is. So an ordinary galaxy, ordinary matter sort of falls to the center of the galaxy and sticks there and forms stars and planets and so forth. The dark matter, because it doesn't interact, doesn't have any reason to stick anywhere. So a dark matter particle falls into the center, but then it comes right out the other side. And as a result, we believe that dark matter is more spread out, is more thinly distributed throughout the universe. There's more of it some places than others, but it's a lot less lumpy than the visible matter.
So let's move on to dark energy. What do we mean by dark energy then? How is that? Is that related to dark matter, or is it completely different?
It's completely different, except that it's dark. In fact, the dark matter, like I said, it's really not that surprising there's something called dark matter. It's quite surprising that there's something called dark energy. The name is not very good because lots of things are dark, everything has energy, but the attempt is to emphasize that it's not matter. It's a form of energy that does not take the form of particles that move around, that dilute away as the universe expands. The dark energy is really there in every point of space at about the same amount. So not only at every point from here to there, but also at every moment of time. The density of dark energy, the amount of dark energy in every cubic centimeter, was the same 2 billion years ago as it is today. The dark energy is smoothly spread out, and it's constant in time. And that's just a very different thing than you'd expect from any form of matter or radiation.
I want to talk about how this relates to what is still, I think, quite a
quite a controversial theory, which is about modified gravity, which mm-hmm. is alternative theories of gravity. Let's talk about why they became necessary because of the discovery of dark energy.
Well, it's an obvious thing because dark matter and dark energy haven't been detected directly, mm-hmm. which means we haven't really touched them with our fingers or even with some laboratory equipment. All we've done is indirectly noticed their influence, in particular their influence through the force of gravity. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly a logical possibility that there is no dark matter and dark energy, but that instead gravity is acting differently than our best theories would predict. Now, this would be a surprise. We generally, in physics, we imagine that when our theories go wrong, they go wrong at short distances and high energies because there's just realms we can't access. But for dark matter and dark energy, where they kick in are at large distances and low energies where we would expect to trust our theories. Nevertheless, you try it out. You know, you write down models. You say, can we modify gravity in such a way as to replace dark matter and dark energy? People have certainly tried, and because it would be kind of really interesting if that were true. And I've tried, and other people have tried. So far, the results are not promising. For dark matter, we have really good evidence that there is gravitational fields pointing in a direction where there is no ordinary matter. So something is causing them, and that something is what we label as dark matter. For dark energy, we just have a really good theory where the dark energy is absolutely constant. It's not dynamical. It's not interesting. It's not doing anything. That simple idea fits all the data really well. And when you try to complicate it by modifying gravity, you generally stop fitting the data. You cause extra effects which are not observed. So it's certainly not true that the game is over. There could absolutely be modifications of gravity, but there's also very strong indications that there really are dark matter and dark energy.
What other implications would there be if you know, we had to come up with a different, an alternative theory of gravity? One of the areas where, for instance, cosmologists and physicists are still looking is in the disjuncture between relativity and quantum mechanics, and you talk about quantum gravity mm-hmm. in the book. So what are the sort of implications are there for the laws of gravity?
Well, gravity is on the one hand the most obvious force in the world, mm-hmm. right? None of us are floating outside of our chairs. We all see apples falling from trees. So we understand that gravity exists. Newton gave a very good theory of gravity way back in the day. It's still pretty good. It's good enough, you know, to get you to the moon and back. Einstein came along with a better theory of gravity in general relativity in the early part of the 20th century. But at the same time as Einstein was inventing general relativity, other physicists were inventing quantum mechanics, which is an even better theory. Quantum mechanics is really necessary to understand how the world works. And general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, doesn't play well with quantum mechanics. Unlike all the other forces and matter particles of nature, which fit very naturally into a quantum mechanical framework, gravity does not. So we're trying very hard to get clues as to how to marry quantum mechanics and gravity. The difficulty is that the regime in which you could do an experiment to help you out is far away from any machine we can possibly build, or even far away from any clues we can get from the external universe. So we really have to use thought experiments. And if there was something going wrong with gravity, something that was modifying gravity on large scales or something like that, maybe a clue from what we think is dark matter and dark energy, that might be crucially important to understanding how to reconcile quantum mechanics and general relativity. Maybe general relativity isn't the final answer, so that could help us out. Or maybe not. You know, we're right up here against absolutely cutting-edge research in physics. We're speculating about what's going on. We have to do what scientists are trained to do, to consider all the possible hypotheses and let the data ultimately decide.
So let's get into From Eternity to Here, then, your book. And it's a book that ranges across all of the universe, all of cosmology and theoretical physics, but ultimately it's concerned with time.
That's right.
Time's is something we're all familiar with. We experience it every day, constantly. It's quite a difficult concept to pin down, though, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. It's a difficult concept to get exactly right. But it's not a difficult concept to use. When we say, all right, I'm going to, you know, meet you at the coffee shop at 5 p.m., everyone knows what that means. It's very, very straightforward. We can do it. Time is much like space. It's a label on different aspects of the universe. But when we get confused is when we try to ask how time works. Why, in particular, the past and future are so different. Mm-hmm. If time is like space, one of the crucial features of space is that all the directions are basically the same. You know, you don't really have an intrinsic directionality mm-hmm. to space. But time, there's obviously a huge difference between one direction, the past, and the other direction, the future. You can remember the past, you can't remember the future. You can make a choice that affects things in the future, mm-hmm. but we don't think that you can affect what happened in the past. So the good news is that physicists really have pinned it down the mystery. The mystery is not why the past is different from the future. That is explained by something called entropy, mm-hmm. growing with time. The universe is becoming more chaotic and disorderly. The real mystery is, why was the entropy so low in the early universe? Why was the universe ever so orderly? And so that's ultimately a question for cosmologists like me.
At this point, I'd ordinarily say we'll start at the beginning of the universe, but actually, as it will turn out in the conversation, that might not necessarily be the case. But let's look at the centrality of the Big Bang, basically, to time and to our understanding of time. So it's often thought that time began with the Big Bang. So is that a strictly correct statement?
It is not a strictly correct statement, or at least we don't know whether it is correct or not. The Big Bang is not, should not be thought of as the beginning of the universe. It should be thought of as the end of our understanding of the universe. Exactly because we don't understand how gravity and quantum mechanics play well together, we don't understand what happened at the Big Bang, because that's certainly a moment when both gravity and quantum mechanics were crucially important. Mm-hmm. And therefore, again, what we should do is consider all the possibilities. One possibility is that the universe began at the Big Bang. That was truly the beginning. Another possibility is that the Big Bang is just a phase the universe goes through, that there was something before the Big Bang. We don't know what it was, but the Big Bang was the result of some events that preceded it, and now we're in the aftermath. So we should absolutely contemplate all of those possibilities and try to build theories that match what we know about what the Big Bang was actually like.
You talked before about the direction of time, the arrow of time. So is it necessary for time to have that one direction? Is that just an unbreakable law of physics, or is that just how it happened in this case?
It is absolutely not necessary for time to have a direction. In fact, one of the amazing features that we're still struggling to come to terms with of the laws of physics is that the deep down laws of physics, whether they're from Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein or Erwin Schrödinger, who invented quantum mechanics, or superstring theory or whatever, none of them have a difference between the past and the future built into them. They all treat the past and future completely indistinguishably. So the reason why we observe such a very strong difference between the past and the future is because of our environment, the universe we find ourselves in. It's not because of the deep down laws of physics. So that was a great triumph of 19th century physics. People like Ludwig Boltzmann, the great Austrian physicist, understood why the past is different from the future if we assume that the whole shebang started in a very specific state, mm-hmm. and has been evolving ever since then.
Okay, so that we're talking now about entropy. Let's bring entropy into the conversation. So what implication does that have on the direction that time goes?
Entropy is just a way of counting how messy or disorganized something is. So an unbroken egg has a very low entropy, a broken egg has a higher entropy, and scrambled eggs have higher entropy yet. And you'll notice that the natural tendency of things is to go from low entropy to high entropy. You can break an egg and then scramble it, no problem. Taking the scrambled egg and unbreaking it and making it into the pristine egg, very, very difficult. The amazing thing is that that simple fact, that the universe goes from orderly to disorderly, underlies every single difference between the past and the future. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can remember the past is ultimately because the entropy used to be lower in the past. The fact that you can affect the future by making choices is ultimately because the future has a higher entropy. So if we could only understand why the early universe had a lower entropy and started out so organized, all of the other mysteries of time would fall into place.
So you mentioned before all of the laws of physics are not affected whether or not they're running backwards or forwards in time, basically, but we should talk about the second law of thermodynamics here, because this is the law that's always cited to suggest that, entropy is always going to move in one direction.
That's right. In fact, it's a very funny history of this law of physics. The law was invented first. The concept that it uses, entropy, was invented second. And the definition of entropy was invented third. So we actually understood the basic feature that the second law encompasses long before we got the details right. And that basic feature is just irreversibility, that some things happen in one direction of time and never unhappen. That if you put two objects together with different temperatures, they come to the same temperature. If you put two objects together with the same temperature, they never unequilibrate. The heat from one object never flows to another one if they started out at the same temperature. So there's a directionality in what happens. And this directionality was summed up in the 19th century as the second law of thermodynamics, which we now say as entropy always increases or stays constant. It never spontaneously goes down. And it follows hard on the heels of the first law, which just says that energy is conserved. So you get a feeling for how important these laws are. First law is conservation of energy. Second law is increase of entropy.
You sort of vaguely alluded to it there, but let's talk a little bit about, there's a great thought experiment, Maxwell's demon. Tell us about that.
Well, once the 19th century physicists started thinking about entropy, one of the great ideas and also more controversial ideas was the idea of atoms. In the 19th century, physicists didn't believe in atoms. You know, they thought there were gases and solids and blah, blah, blah. The chemists had caught on to atoms, but the physicists were still reluctant because they couldn't see them, and they were pretty down-to-earth people. But people like Maxwell, Boltzmann, Hosiah Willard Gibbs here in the United States, they realized that if you thought that gases and fluids that all these people were talking about were made of atoms, then they could explain all these laws of thermodynamics. But Maxwell, who was most famous for his work in electricity and magnetism, invented this thought experiment, which he said would allow entropy to decrease rather than increase. What if you do have a box of gas divided in two, and the temperature is the same on both sides, so the entropy is very high, it's an equilibrium state, and left to its own devices, it would just sit there forever. But in addition, you have a little demon who can watch the different atoms inside both sides of the box of gas, and when a high temperature, high velocity atom was moving in one direction, it would let it through, but not if it were moving in the other direction. When a low velocity, low temperature atom was moving in the other direction, it would let it through, but not the other way. So gradually, through the work of this demon, without the demon actually touching any of the atoms, just letting them through one way or the other, all of the hot gas would accumulate on one side, all of the cold gas would accumulate on the other side, violating the second law of thermodynamics. Now, everyone instantly knew that clearly what was going on was that somehow the demon was raising the entropy of the universe some other way. But it was very difficult to quite pinpoint how that was happening. And in fact, to be honest, it wasn't really answered to most people's satisfaction until the 1980s. It was very difficult to understand what was going on, and it came down to a crucial connection between physics and information. Information is a physical quantity, and what the demon needs is not to touch the atoms, but it needs the information about what the atoms are doing. And it needs to record that information in a little notebook. And at some point, it has to erase the notebook, because otherwise it would just fill up infinitely big, which you're not allowed to do. And that erasing of the notebook is where the demon increases the entropy of the universe. Because if you think about it, erasing something is an irreversible process. Writing something down, you can unwrite. But once you erase it, you can't get it back. So we now understand why Maxwell's demon does increase the entropy of the universe, but by thinking about it, we invented a whole field of study called information theory.
So you just talked about irreversible processes, and I guess the conditions that the universe is set in, that there are these processes that are irreversible, again, is contingent on the forward flow of time. So let's spend some time looking at whether or not does it violate the laws of physics to reverse time. I mean, is, you know, the obvious question there is time travel possible?
Right. So time travel is probably not possible, but it is mixed up with the second law of thermodynamics and the irreversibility of our world in an interesting way. Because, again, the second law is a reflection of our environment. It's not built into the deep down laws of physics. If you have, for example, a movie of the Earth going around the sun, so you're out there in a satellite and you're just watching the Earth going around the sun, you can play that movie backwards and nobody would know. Mm-hmm. It looks exactly the same forwards and backwards. It's only when you add many, many, many pieces to it that the irreversibility becomes manifest. So we happen to live in a universe where irreversible things happen. Now, what if you could travel backward in time? Well, then you're mixing up the past with the future. Mm-hmm. If I personally, right now, here in 2012, went back and visited 1970, then my future, my next day, the next day of my life, would be in 1970, which right now I think of as the past. So if you allow for time travel, you can't have a consistent directionality in time. If you're able to loop backwards and go to the past, then entropy can't simply increase everywhere uniformly throughout the universe. So something has to give. And the easiest thing to give is that you can't travel backward in time.
I wanted to, at this point, bring up the concept of space-time. We've talked about Einstein a couple of times, and this is the general theory of relativity is concerned with space-time. So let's talk about that concept. What do we mean when we say space-time?
Well, you could have talked about space-time long before Einstein. It was always true that if you want to meet that person at the cafe at 5 o'clock, you tell them two things. Where the cafe is located in space, which requires three numbers in principle, because space is three-dimensional, and when the meeting is located in time. So both space and time serve as coordinates on the universe, ways of labeling different events that help you find things. But the point was that if you were Newton, space and time were just so different from each other in other ways that you weren't tempted to join them together to space-time. But when Einstein came along, he realized that our conventional division of space-time into space versus time was not universal. It was not absolute. It depends on who is doing the dividing. And in particular, it depends on how fast you're moving. If you move close to the speed of light, your version of which is space and which is time is different than somebody who's standing still. And in this way, he was able to reconcile Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism with what we knew about the rest of the world. And he was ultimately able to build general relativity, his theory of gravity. So we're sure that it's true that the right way to think about the universe is in terms of space-time, not space and time separately. We're still struggling to understand why time is a little bit different than space.
Sticking with our own personal universe for the moment, what do we expect to see in the future? Because presumably we're heading to a point where entropy becomes infinitely high, I guess. There's going to be a point where there is, you know, very, very, very high entropy. So what happens at the end?
That's right. So if you have a box of gas and you start it out of equilibrium in a low entropy state with, you know, all the gas on one side of the box or one half of the gas hot and the other half cold, it will equilibrate, it will smooth out, and it will be high entropy, and then it sits there basically forever, right? So what about the universe? Well, our universe started about 13.7 billion years ago, our observable part of the universe at the Big Bang. The entropy has been going up ever since. It got a little bit lumpier for a while as stars and planets formed. In the future, it will get less lumpy because the stars will burn up all their fuel, they'll fall into black holes, and those black holes will radiate away. They will evaporate, according to Stephen Hawking's discovery in the 1970s. And the whole time, the universe is expanding. Different galaxies are moving away from each other, so the universe is becoming emptier and emptier. Once all the stars fall into black holes and the black holes all evaporate, we will have nothing but empty space. And as far as we know, that will last forever. We're not sure about that. Obviously, we're extrapolating into the future, and we don't know exactly what's going to go on. But one possibility is certainly that it will last forever. So that's as high as the entropy can possibly get. But even there, in the universe, there's still dark energy. If we're right that the dark energy is absolutely constant, then there will still be dark energy, and that will mean that the amount of entropy that you can see in the universe always remains finite, because the dark energy pushes the universe apart and makes it the case that there's only ever a finite amount of stuff that you can see. So even though the entropy reaches a maximum, to any one observer, it reaches a finite maximum and will stay there forever. It will be a very, very boring and inhospitable universe once that happens.
Well, perhaps at that point, then, we might be looking at moving on to another universe, if that's feasible. Let's talk about the possibility that, you know, we're talking about a universe that has conditions where time goes in one direction.
Right.
Is it feasible, then, that there are other places where that's not necessarily the case?
Well, it's feasible that there are other places where the direction of time is different than it is in our place of the universe. It is not feasible where there are places where different people in the same universe have different arrows of time. As soon as they touched each other, interacted with each other, saw each other in any way, something would have to give and their arrows of time would have to come into alignment. So you can imagine a different part of the universe, very, very far away in space, or very, very far away in time, in the far, far, far past or the far, far, far future, regions of the universe where the arrow of time pointed in another direction. That's just a natural thing to imagine once you realize that the arrow of time comes because of our environment, not because of the deep down laws of physics.
So let's look at the idea of a multiverse then. Where did this idea first come from, that there's a possibility that we are just one of a multitude of universes?
Well, there's a historical question here that is fascinating. Giordano Bruno, who lived just before Galileo, had this idea that stars were just like the sun, and that there were an infinite number of stars, and around them were different planets with different worlds, with different people on them. And so his tongue was ripped out, and he was burned at the stake for that and other reasons. But it wasn't science, right? He was just sort of speculating about this. Ludwig Boltzmann, who made our modern conception of entropy, also imagined an infinitely big universe where there were sort of statistical random fluctuations in different parts of the universe, and that these statistical fluctuations in different regions gave rise to an arrow of time. So that in some regions, the arrow of time would be pointing in one direction, and other regions would be pointing in another direction. He didn't know about the Big Bang or general relativity or anything like that. So these days, with the Big Bang and with a theory invented by Alan Guth called inflation, which says that you can start with an incredibly tiny patch of universe and blow it up to include 100 billion galaxies like we see around us today. Now you have this way of, because space and time are flexible, making all the universes you want. So we certainly take seriously the idea that there is a multiverse, that different universes pop in and out of existence in different parts of reality. Some of them might have arrows of time that point in different directions. We haven't yet, and we might not in the next year or two, settle on one favorite picture for how this whole thing works. But clearly there's a very good chance it's related in some way to the question of why our universe started with such low entropy.
To what extent are, apart from the tongue ripping, to what extent are sort of modern cosmologists any different from Giordano Bruno in that, you know, to what extent is there any observable evidence for any of this, or are we really speculating? And I say that quite, you know, quite provocatively, but it's, we're talking about such huge concepts that it seems, is it likely that we will ever have what we would describe as experimental evidence for any of these concepts? A multiverse, for instance, or what happened before the Big Bang, for instance.
Well, it is different than Bruno, because he was just flat-out speculating, whereas the modern cosmologists start with quite a firm framework, which is what we currently understand about gravity and quantum mechanics. We do understand something. We're not just guessing. In fact, inflation and the multiverse that naturally comes out of inflation didn't come about because people said, well, maybe a multiverse would be a cool thing to think about. They came about because the equations that make inflation work predict that there will be a multiverse, whether you like it or not. It just comes out of the math. Now, that doesn't mean the math is right. It's the math that we have developed to try to understand the universe we do observe. But the most likely possibility is that if we ever become confident that there is a multiverse, it's because we have established a firm understanding of the laws of physics within the observable universe, and then we say, and those laws of physics predict the existence of a multiverse. That's the ultimate realistic goal. A less realistic goal, but something to sort of we're hopeful about, is that there is somehow a shadow, a remnant, a fossil, an indication of what's happening outside our observable universe that the multiverse has imprinted on the universe we do observe. Maybe one bubble of space-time has bumped into our bubble of space-time and left a signature in the cosmic background radiation from the Big Bang, for example. This is something people are actively looking for. I mean, we'd all love to find it. So it's absolutely true that the ultimate criterion for accepting or rejecting a view is what the data tell you. It's not your theoretical speculation. But if your theoretical speculations, guided by the data, make a prediction that you have a right to believe, then you should take it seriously. That's what being a respectable scientist is all about.
We'll leave looking at the book. We'll leave looking at the contents of the book at this particular point. I'd just like to finish off. During this trip, one of the themes of the trip is to be looking at science in an American context, and I'd like, particularly in terms of popular science, in the acknowledgments of the book, you describe just meeting people in coffee shops and bars and how interested people are in talking about incredibly complicated cosmologies. Do you find that? Let's talk about the appetite for popular science in the US.
I find that all the time. I mean, there's two attitudes out there that are opposed to each other, and they're both certainly there. One is a defensiveness. You know, I didn't do well in physics in high school. I don't want to talk about that. You know, I have more pressing practical needs to attend to, and I sympathize with that, and I appreciate it. But at least as much, you get people who realize that in addition to the practical needs of getting through life, we are by nature curious animals. We want to understand how the universe around us works. And I would argue that scientists actually underserve the general public in explaining what it is we're doing and why it's interesting. We're obviously, you know, there's a bunch of smart people working very hard, devoting their lives to asking what sound like really esoteric, abstract questions. But they can be explained, and they should be explained, and when you do a good job of it, people are very, very interested. There's a huge number of people who would love to understand science better if it were presented to them in an interesting way. And a lot of people are doing it. There's a lot of, you know, great work in spreading the word and communicating science. But there's room for much, much more. So I'm always very happy to add my little contribution to helping people understand what a cool universe it is that we live in.
That's brilliant. So I've been talking to Sean Carroll. Sean, thank you very much for talking to me today.
My pleasure.
I'm Leonard Susskind. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on the Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.